Hello and welcome to episode 15.5 of the Nashy Cast. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And we are here today for, well, as I said, a 0.5 episode. And we're going to be discussing what I consider to be one of the biggies of Spanish horror, especially of the 1970s. A film that, well, I'm not the only one who holds this film in really high regard. I think that anybody who is a fan of the horror genre probably will get a kick out of it. We are, of course, today talking about Tombs of the Blind Dead. Mm-hmm. I love this film, and I love its three sequels, even the really, really stupid one. Okay, it's not that it's it's kind of stupid. Mm-hmm. I'll grant you that the third one is kind of stupid. Today we're talking about, I'm going to fight the urge to talk about all four of them, mainly because I haven't watched all four of them back to back in a long time.
Mm-hmm. I imagine we will get to all of them before we're said and done. And I'm looking forward to that. For me, I've still really, come before this, I had actually only seen, the ones I had watched, I'd only seen one time. And then there's still one that I've not seen at all, so I'm looking forward to this.
Oh, really? Which one?
It's the, I guess it'd be the second one. The second one I've actually never, I have it, but I've still not watched it yet. I would have by now, but knowing that we would probably be getting to the show, I'm going to hold it back, but I've, because the second one is the Return, I guess the one that's called Return. Okay, that's the one I've not seen, but I've seen Night of the Seagulls, and I've seen Ghost Galleon, but I'm looking forward to rewatching all of them. I very much enjoyed watching this one again.
Well, that's interesting. I had no idea that you hadn't seen all four of them because, well, the big debate amongst Blind Dead fans is usually between which you think is the best of the four, and it's always a question of the first or the second one. There are some people who will argue that the second one is better than the first one, and it's a fine argument to have. And there's some points on both sides of that argument. It's been a while since I've watched the second one, so right now, as far as I'm concerned, the first one's the best.
Yeah,
because I just watched it again.
Yeah, right. I mean, of the three, and again, yes, the first, this one is one I would consider the best too. But I came into the whole Blind Dead thing kind of an odd way. Once again, it was one of the many, many things that, as we've mentioned before, and we'll probably mention again, the wonderful Phil Hardy edited encyclopedia, the Penguin book, which I guess are now called the Overlook.
The Overlook Encyclopedia
of horror that turned me on to, I first read about Paul Naschy and Coffin Joe and also The Blind Dead. When I was reading about the films, I thought, these sound so great. I remember coming across an old VHS of, I think it was called Ship of Zombies, whatever one of the alternate titles of Ghost Galleon was.
Yeah.
So that was literally my first, my introduction into The Blind Dead. And I don't know if that was really the best place to begin, mainly because, for one thing... this was also, of course, a very panned and scanned version of it to begin with. I mean, not obviously a great print. I mean, it wasn't terrible, but again, it was not.
But I still remember what your takeaway.
Oh,
from
you remember that what
was.
I always remembered. I was
yes. never your takeaway but, still kills me to this day because years before I got to see Ghost Galleon,
right.
Your stories of I can't remember which one of the Blind Dead films it is, and you're telling the story of the ending shot.
Not a whole lot of money was spent on ship special effects and special effects in general.
What did you say? It looked like a toy boat in a wash tub being set on fire and filmed very poorly or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I remembered from it. So even in that film, I still thought the design of the Blind Dead was just such a wonderful design. I think the ship was even more wooden than Jack Taylor himself in that film. I didn't just go leaping with gusto after that to watch the rest of the Blind Dead films. But luckily after that, I think the next one I saw was Night of the Seagulls before I actually even finally got to see the first one. And I know Elena does not like Night of the Seagulls, but I do.
Which
and,
makes no sense.
Yeah, I do like
that
it.
That makes no sense.
But right now Tombs is the best, but I'm really looking forward to seeing all these again. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Cool. Well, I think what we'll do is for some more Beyond Nashy Cast episodes, we will have to do some more Osorio. Probably not just the Blind Dead films, but he did some other great films as well, which we'll talk about. We'll at least touch on and mention. The argument as to which is the best of the four, I almost always tend to fall back on the first one, although the second one is a blast as well. the way I first came to these films was through the first one. The first one I ever saw was the very first one. And I came to it very late in the day. I came to it in the 90s, having read about it in various places. I'm guessing the Phil Hardy books, as well as a few other places as well. I just heard tell of them for so long. And the first time I ever saw it was when it got issued on Laserdisc over here in the States. That's how I first saw it. And I was I was already primed for something really special and something kind of out of the ordinary, but also kind of the perceived wisdom was that this was, you know, a minor, you know, Euro trash classic. And I was not disappointed in the least by what I saw. I was just absolutely stunned by the film the first time I saw it and watched it over and over again. There was a period of time where I watched Tombs of the Blind Dead and the Corman Poe films on like a constant loop, where I just watched them over and over and over again.
Yeah,
especially once they were available widescreen, where you could actually see the full image. I've been in love with them for a long time.
I think that, you know, I don't know if there's such thing as a casual Euro horror fan. You know, I don't know if that's, it's like you're either in it or you're not. But let's say if you're just getting into, if you're into European horror films, but let's say that you have an awareness of them to a degree, and haven't just totally gone all out and delved into them, you probably, if someone mentions Spanish horror, you're going to think three things: Jess Franco, El Hombre Lobo, and The Blind Dead. You know, so that's what, you know, those are probably the three icons of, you know, iconic, you know, things of Spanish horror when people think about, you know, that.
It's very true. The thing is, I think one of the minor stumbling blocks might be that, if you're just thinking Euro horror, a lot of the Spanish horror stuff gets lumped in and doesn't see. It's harder to kind of separate it from the Italian horror stuff. So
right. I agree.
With that. Right next to that would be the Argento and Fulci stuff. So you've got things like The Beyond and Zombie and Suspiria, all kind of in that same big melting pot. And to a degree, I think that's how you kind of have to start out, because it wasn't until well after I started getting really into it and reading as much as I could about these films that I started to figure out, okay, well, this one was a Spanish production. And then realizing that what you need to pay attention to really, as far as what kind of film you kind of are going to be expecting, is, okay, was it an Italian? You know, who are the people behind the camera? Are they Italians? Are they Spaniards? Are they French? What are they?
It's true, because generally speaking, the Italian filmmakers, Bava, Fulci, and Argento, have certainly gotten really overall wider exposure and wider press. And so, yeah, when you're just starting to get into that stuff and discovering this whole other world, those are kind of the ones that hit you first, you know. And so everything, you know, you think of everything as Italian horror, and then it just sort of, then you start to branch off into these things that came from, you know, you get to start to, you know, understand the countries, the things particular to their films, and
you start discovering the connections, and of course the thing is, I mean, you start following the directors and some of the actors, and they just lead you from one thing to the other, it was all very incestuous as far as the productions were concerned anyway.
But in this case, interesting thing, we'll certainly touch on the fact of, you know, obviously these, you know, the connections between Paul Naschy's films. One of those connections is not Del Sorio, you know, Del Sorio. And it's interesting, then it's even more when you're interesting after seeing how much they're connected, when you run across the big the major figures that never did actually cross paths, in at least in sense of working with one another, how long it took Jess Franco and Paul Naschy to even meet, and Naschy never worked with Osorio, which is hard to, it's amazing, it's hard to believe, especially considering, let's just go and say right now, this film, I mean, what a time for Spanish horror, because this film came out practically the same time as Werewolf Shadow was made. You know, it seems like they share about the same production time, which is always makes that debate interesting, because they share so many similar film techniques and things or ideas, you know, as the fact that they sort of, were they happening simultaneously? Did one come out and immediately influence the other, or that sort of thing, you know, as far as the whole slow motion aspect, you know, the way they film the creatures and that sort of thing. Well, or was it just a big coincidence, or, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and it's always going to be one of those things that's up for debate. And if there's a part of me that wonders if there was, you know, some kind of sniping behind the scenes at the time with, you know, always copying this, or he's copying that. Or
the one thing we have no doubt about is what the answer would be, is if we could ask Osorio and Naschy today what they would say.
Both would claim to have done it first.
And but that's cool, though. It's just amazing to think that these two films, I mean, probably the two biggest films in early Spanish horror history, along with like Dr. Orloff or something like that. I mean, these are like just huge in that. that as far as the horror industry of the 70s in Spain, and the fact they came out at the same time, like what an incredible time.
Oh, I know. Those first few years of the 70s, man, it's just... And the thing is, here's an amazing thing to think about. I mean, not just in European horror, but those first years of the 70s were an amazing time for American films, too, for Hollywood movies as well. Yes,
very true, true.
My God, think about what came out in that stretch from 1970 to 1975.
Mm-hmm.
That was that's amazing stuff coming out then. But, you know, I just realized that eventually for a Beyond Nashy episode, we're probably going to have to do a Jess Franco movie.
We will, and that's going to be tough because there's so few to choose from. You know,
yeah, like he only made.
So, I know it's like he only made what 300, I think. So how do we?
Something
gonna...
like that.
Anyway, I think I think we're going to take a little break, and then Rod is going to come back with a synopsis of the film. And the thing I really hate is the fact that y'all won't be able to see, the listeners won't be able to see the fact that he's going to be acting it out as he's going to be giving it to you.
I have put on my blind dead leotard, and I shall be conducting a dance.
If only you could see it, folks. If only you could see it.
God, avert your eyes.
Blind terror strikes fear into the hearts of innocent people. The morgue receives the victims of the blind dead. There's no escape from the blind dead. They are the Templars, devil worshippers, a death cult that has risen from their thousand-year-old tombs to begin a horrible reign of terror.
Please, wait!
Pop, look over there!
A beautiful young girl is trapped by the evil forces. No one is safe from their curse.
They're coming!
Human sound in the ancient cemetery brings the evil creatures from their tombs. The Templars perform their sadistic rites. A virgin is sacrificed in a blood ritual. Fiery death for those who can't escape the blind dead. Coming soon from your cemetery.
All right, Tombs of the Blind Dead, 1971, directed and written by Armando Di Osorio. Let's get a few of the preliminaries out of the way before I get to the synopsis. Let's talk alternate titles.
Mm-hmm.
First, allow me to lodge a formal complaint.
Yes, yes, this is
with the Internet Movie Database.
This is an affront.
Not this will not be the first time I have bitched about something on the IMDb.
Mm.
But let's just say that right now, calling a movie that should be known by aficionados of the genre well as Tombs of the Blind Dead, trying to call it Mark of the Devil Part 4, Tombs of the Blind Dead, is an affront, an insult, and indeed does me mental and physical harm. This is wrong. This is very wrong. It has nothing to do with Mark of the Devil. There were only two Mark of the Devil movies in the first place. Mark of the Devil Yeah, Mark of the Devil Part 2.
Now, I'm assuming that it was released somewhere under that Mark of the Devil Part 4 title. But what you're saying is the IMDb should know better. It's like, exactly. That should not be its principal. This is its principal listing on IMDb is Mark of the Devil Part 4. Yeah, you're right.
Which is psychotic.
It is. It is.
Okay, but on to actual real... how am I differentiating? Real alternate titles.
Real fake titles.
Okay, real alternate titles. In Spain, the film was known as The Night of the... Oh, what the heck was that again?
Night of the Blind Terror.
Night of the Blind Terror, that's right. That's the English translation of the Spanish title, which is, hey, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Somewhere else, it was perhaps known as Crypt of the Blind Dead.
Mm-hmm. Now, why somebody looked and said, that word tomb just bothers me. What else? Crypt. Crypt. It says, okay, why somebody spent, I hope they didn't spend a whole lot of time redoing all the posters.
Yeah. Oh, who the hell knows? What are the titles? There was, The Revolt of the Living Dead.
Revolt of the Living Dead was the French title.
Tombs of the Resuscitated Dead.
Tombs of the Resuscitated Dead.
That's Italy.
Yeah, that's that. You know, now I don't know about you, but I would not have wanted to give one of the blind dead mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
I'm just figuring that once you press down on the chest, you just cave right in.
Yeah.
Okay. Night of the Blind Dead. Mm-hmm. All right. And then just plain The Blind Dead, which, okay, yeah, that works. Night of the Blind Terror, Tombs of the Blind Dead. So there you have.
Essentially, if you take the word terror, blind, tomb, and dead, chop them up,
fling them in the air.
Whatever you come down with is it will work.
That's going to be one of our possible.
It's like a Mad Lib. Right, it's like a Mad blind Dead, Blind Dead, blind mad, dead Mad Lib edition.
That could actually be fun.
Yeah, it could.
Okay, well, a quick synopsis of our film, Tombs of the Blind Dead, 1971. The film. Well, let's start this way. On the there are essentially two different cuts of the film that you can find. You can find the original Spanish language cut on the Blue Underground DVD. They actually give you both. Mm-hmm. There's the Spanish language cut, and then there's the English language cut. I sometimes see it referred to as the American version. But whatever, it is essentially much shorter. They chopped about 15 minutes out of the film, which will be the first thing that tells you, I don't want to see this. The second thing you'll notice is that they rearrange some things
in, which is
really irritating. Mm-hmm. They take a flashback scene that's structured much later in the film when you get some information about the genesis or origin of the Blind Dead. Yeah, the legend, essentially. And they put that right at the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. And then they have the credit sequence.
Yeah.
Well, that really kind of blows one of the most amazing things about the way the film begins, because the Spanish version, which is the preferred version as far as I'm concerned, is wonderful because it starts with the opening credits. And while the incredibly creepy music plays along with... It's not just music, it's sound effects. The theme music
is just one of the most amazing theme songs. Unfortunately, one that they used again, which, you know... Poor El Hombre Lobo never got a specific, you know, he should have gotten an actual theme song at some point, and he never really got one associated with it, whereas the Blind Dead always had their signature.
I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. Like you said,
it's almost hard to think of it as to call it just music. It's just some bizarre jumble of all sorts of sounds and instruments and noises that's just truly unnerving. It's a terrific theme song.
It's amazing stuff, and of course I'll put it here in the podcast just to give everybody a taste of it. But as the film begins, over the opening credits, this creepy music and sound effects are playing, and we're being shown these ruins. Now later in the film we learn what those ruins specifically are, but what's great about this is that the credit sequence is a couple of minutes long, about two minutes longer, a little longer, and so we're seeing these deserted ruins of a medieval town, and its cemetery and the abbey and all this stuff under this music, and that is what moves us into the story. Mm-hmm. And it's great because it establishes this place and establishes kind of the setting and everything, and just from the opening credits, you wouldn't even be able to tell if it was going to be... a contemporary set tale or a period piece. Right after the credits, they do this nice, amazing little slam, which is just for a few seconds, they show you this crazed-looking woman with blonde hair whose clothes are all messed up, just screaming right at you. And then a train whistle pops, And we go into this very nice scene at poolside,
yeah,
on a at a resort on a beach, mm-hmm, in Portugal.
Yeah. No, it is a wonderful transition there. It's just, it's great to put you right in there where suddenly we're in this place of death and gloom, and then suddenly that we jump to this place of all modern, beautiful people, vibrant,
yeah,
and just, you know, it's a great transition.
This vacation hotspot with all, yeah, these beautiful people around the pool and everything, yeah, is, the music completely changes. It's very jazzy, cool, and very, very, you know, and basically you're just suddenly looking at all these incredibly beautiful bikini-clad women.
Well, too. What's great is the one you see focused directly immediately on is the main character, Bette, or Elizabeth, or whatever they call
it. Well, it's in the Spanish version, it's Bette, B-E-T. Yeah. In the English version, it's Beth, which is, you know, cool.
But you don't know, played by, I think, Lona Fleming is her name, I believe, yeah, it or not, but you don't know that this is the major character you're seeing coming down these stairs, you know, like you're so taken in this whole scene.
Well, she's not the woman coming down the stairs. The woman that you see first in the stairs has a white bikini on, and then you follow her down a little bit, and then you go over. Remember, Bette is wearing a red bikini.
Oh, okay, okay.
And that's one of the neat things is that...
Oh,
just,
I see.
She,
okay,
that,
so I was wrong about that. Okay.
What it is that... But the thing is, that just immediately has you start looking around at all these bikini-clad, yeah, beautiful women around this pool. And so when they finally focus in and you see the character Virginia spot Bette,
right,
and then call to her, it's just like, hey, cool, two hot chicks who know each other. Let's have a conversation. I'm good with that.
The guy that's with him is quite happy with the situation, too.
Yeah, true, true. Well, what it is these two women haven't seen each other for a few years. They just kind of accidentally meet here at this vacation resort. And they went to school together and were very good friends in school. Virginia is there with her current boyfriend or just traveling companion, whatever, a guy named Roger. Roger seems very taken with Beth, as I think almost anyone would be, and invites her to go along with them on their outing the next day. She agrees, even though it seems pretty obvious that Virginia doesn't really think... Virginia's obviously thinking three's a crowd here. I don't know if this is a good idea.
Yeah.
But the next day, they do all end up on the same train. During the course of it, Virginia gets more and more upset about the situation and decides to just get off the train. And since the train doesn't stop, it's a nonstop between the place they're leaving from and the destination, she just jumps off the train. Now, we're introduced to the engine drivers of the train, and one of them is an older guy, and the younger guy is even his son. He's learning the trade. They don't stop there, and the older man explains there's a reason, because there's a big section of the land that they go through that he considers cursed, and he's not about to stop there no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So Virginia exits herself from the train. The reason she does this is that she sees some ruins up on the hill and thinks that it might actually just be a town,
mm-hmm,
and she just wants to get away from these two people because she's upset.
Mm-hmm.
She travels to the ruins, and we are quickly enough able to pick up on the fact that, hey, these are the ruins we saw under the credits.
Mm-hmm.
She beds down for the evening, and just her presence alone seems to bring out the, I guess, the only things, quote-unquote, living in these ruins, and that would be the zombified corpses of, well, the blind dead.
We have our title characters.
Yeah. They come out, they chase her around, scare the living crap out of her, and what I love is that this is where we can start talking about all the neat details.
Mm-hmm.
The knights are shot, the zombified knights are shot mostly in slow motion.
Yeah.
And they even have ghostly horses that they ride.
Mm-hmm.
Ghostly zombified horses. I always think of this as just one of the coolest supernatural conceits of all time.
It's a great idea. Just the whole design of the Blind Dead is just fantastic. I mean, the cloaks that they wear, I mean, they're so mottled and rancid and decayed, you know, they just, and I love the fact that where they can get away with it, they use actual skeleton hands instead of hands, or actual skeleton hands, you know, where they can film it and get away with that effect is just, is a great idea. Yeah, the way and just the way they moved, the whole image of them going, you know, all galloping in slow motion. Through, you know, you never get tired of seeing that. It's just.
Well, I also love that the desiccated and dried faces where it's done as if they're not skulls, but it's as if the flesh has, you know, just kind of just deteriorated onto the bone, and there's just a thin veneer of stuff that looks like just dried, crusted, semi-desiccated flesh. And some of them still have like the straggling hairs of what was obviously a beard.
Yeah, I love that.
Dangling off the chins. Mm-hmm. It's just an incredibly creepy image.
One of the things, you know, about there's always, you know, a tendency a lot of times in horror movies to whether it's a zombie or a Frankenstein monster or something moves really slow that people can't get away from it, you know, to laugh or kind of chuckle at that idea. What's nice about The Blind Dead is because you never really get a fix on exactly how many of them there are. So when somebody's running around in a place, you know, everywhere they try and turn a corner, and there's suddenly one of them there. And so the fact that they move really slowly, it's not a hindrance here, because basically you never really know how many of them there are. So it never feels unreal, or it doesn't feel like it's breaking the interior logic of the film to have, you know, suddenly everywhere you turn, there they are. Now, one thing, talking about the interior logic of the film, and I'm not one to totally pick apart things that are supernaturally based anyway, but I thought it was very interesting that, of course, obviously they're after Virginia, and one of the ways she gets away is at one point she jumps on one of the horses.
One of the horses, okay. Yes.
So you described them as, you know, as ghostly horses, but it's not only interesting that she can ride one, but the fact that it goes with her, it allows her to take off with it. So it's very interesting about that way with the.
It is fascinating, and they chase her down. They chase her across that plain almost all the way back to the railroad tracks across those acres of ground. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that once she's on the horse and riding it, she's in slow motion then too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's so neat that it's never spelled out, but it just seems like that there are lines that you cross, and then
she's suddenly in their world. She's suddenly in their world. Now you're she's in on their horse. They're in there. She's in So that's pretty cool.
So nevertheless, her body turns up. Her two friends, Beth and Roger, feel really guilty about her having gotten off the train. Mm-hmm. They go looking for her, don't find her. Then her body turns up. They have to identify the body. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the morgue attendant.
The morgue attendant. Yeah, we can't not mention.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me finish the synopsis.
Yeah, okay.
And the rest of the film is the two of them trying to find information out about how their friend was killed, because her body was found with all these bite marks all over it. Mm. They go through various and sundry things that, of course, eventually takes them back to the ruins of this medieval town to have their own little showdown with the blind dead as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, let's start talking about specifics, because the morgue attendant is a completely insane character.
Well, and this is the kind of character that, for some reason, films always feel like they have to make their morgue attendant colorful, you know? I mean, if we ever seen a morgue attendant that was not colorful in some way, if nothing else, they're at least
eating a sandwich
or something, showing some kind of reverence for the dead. I mean, that's the kind of character. You could probably make a whole film reel of just various morgue attendants through film history and how their eccentricities, and of course there's, you know, Goto. I mean, we won't even get into.
Well, no, I was just thinking about the morgue attendant that turned up in a couple of episodes of Kolchak, the Night Stalker.
Classic. Played, what did they call
played
him?
Played by, I can't remember the guy's name.
Yeah,
but it's played by the actor who did Winnie the Pooh's voice.
Sure is. Yeah.
It's completely nuts.
And but boy, this guy is right up there with the messed up. He enjoys his job way too much.
Oh, I know. I kept waiting for them to. Now, here's the weird thing: as messed up and weird as the morgue attendant is, I kept waiting for them to make him into a necrophile.
Right, and yeah,
but they don't. He's just torturing a frog.
Yeah, he's torturing a frog, but at the same time, then lovingly playing around with this little
bird,
parrot, you know, bird. That's
Oh, I know. And he's such a weird looking guy too. He looks like Coffin Joe's Spanish brother.
good catch.
He
I didn't
really
think
does.
About that. Well, you know, my favorite thing of all is the glee he takes with pulling the when they're in there. Bette and Roger are in there to try and identify Virginia's body, and so he's going. Then the police inspector's in the room too, and he tells the morgue attendant he's going to have to you know, unveil, let them look at the body, and he just. He says such pleasure in unraveling, and it's the wrong one. That's
it's
a crash.
Wrong body,
a great moment of humor there, where he reveals this old woman's corpse, and it's totally wrong. So then he has to do it again, but he just has this great look of pleasure. So it's obviously the favorite part of his job is letting people identify the bodies.
Well, you just brought up something that I wanted to touch on. one of the neater things about this movie, and it's something that I don't know that I would have ever expected from the descriptions of the film before I ever saw it, is that the film has some neat little touches of humor.
It does. I agree.
And yeah. Not just humor of that type where you're dealing with a crazy morgue attendant, but there are some other neat little touches of humor as well. When Beth and Roger go to find the smuggler,
Pedro,
who the police suspect of having something to do with Virginia's death. The whole thing where the young girl goes to tell him that someone's here and wants to see him, and she's just hanging around and looking at him until his girlfriend says something. It's just a really funny exchange there.
Yeah.
And there are other instances like that where there's just a little bit of humor in the story to kind of liven it up. It's not a whole dismal kind serious affair at all. Although there are things in the film that are really kind of harsh and some might say even unnecessary. The film doesn't keep itself, it doesn't keep to one tone, and it does vary itself from scene to scene enough so that you're in the hands of a filmmaker who has the ability to shift moods and to change things and to move forward in the narrative without it being a herky jerky kind of thing. It's smooth. I never gotten the sense from watching this movie, as eccentric as the movie is, that its eccentricities are due to a lack of skill. It's always felt like these are technicians who know what they're doing and are doing it well, and in this case it all really kind of comes together. Not that there aren't some problems here and there in the film, but they're very minor.
It is a technically just overall a really, really solidly made film, and incredibly well done and atmospheric, and definitely has just some great images, great ideas, and great ideas in terms of ways of depicting things and showing things are just really well done.
I called Lisbon. Virginia didn't return home last night.
Oh, where could she have gone? You like something, senor?
No, thank you. Just the check, please. What's the village near here towards Lisbon?
No village, sir. There's the mountains. And after the river Guadiana, there's the frontier of Spain.
But what about the one I saw from the train?
You must need Arsano. Ah, but it's been deserted for over 100 years.
But maybe our friend stayed the night there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wouldn't ask about it if I were you, senor.
And just why not ask about it?
Nothing, senor. We're not allowed to talk of such...
Speak up.
The management of this hotel doesn't want anyone to know of our local superstitions. It's not good for tourists. I'm sorry. I can't talk about it anymore.
But you must.
No, please. I don't want to lose my job.
Excuse me. Is there anything wrong, senor? Have you any complaints about the service?
No, not at all. Could I rent a horse here?
Of course, senor. We have excellent hunters.
It doesn't matter. Just one for the country.
Muy bien. You'll find the country very beautiful.
I'd like a horse, too.
Betty, no.
I feel I should go.
There's no telling what we might find at Bazzano.
I'm as curious as you.
Do you want to go to Bassano, senor?
Yes, and superstition be damned.
Now, speaking of the strengths and weaknesses of Tombs of the Blind Dead, let me first bring up the one of the weaknesses I see in it, which is that I do feel that, in reality, almost all the characters are fairly thinly written. Mm-hmm. But then, I have to admit, it's a film, it's a horror movie. I don't need a whole lot of depth to the characters, and essentially they kind of define themselves through what they do.
Well, look at the story. Yeah, so. I see what you mean. You're right about that. I think that look at how much of the film, just from Virginia's whole adventure that night, the whole sequence. Look how much of the film time that takes up of just her experience that night and her encounter with the blind dead. So it's kind of like a film of episodes and adventure. There's these long set pieces there, it's not a real character driven story by any means.
Well, no, but I will admit, if I'm looking at the film critically, the characters are fair. I mean, we know very little. What the hell do we know about Roger?
Yeah, nothing. There was times when I was actually wasn't really sure if he was Virginia's boyfriend or were they? I mean, she acted like, or was it just a case of that she wanted him to be, and they, maybe they hadn't gotten
maybe that, they hadn't really gotten together, but they were trapped. But the thing is, they were traveling together. I mean, so you know, like, you don't really know anything about him. We learn a little bit. We don't really know anything about Virginia either. We learn a good deal more about Beth, mainly because we see where she works, we see what she does for a living, we meet one of her employees, and you know, yada yada yada, but we still don't really know very much about her either. But like I say, that's a pretty minor thing, but it is no, there.
It's a good point.
And having, now that I've seen the film probably, I don't know, in excess of a dozen times, and that's a conservative estimate, you start to think about certain things. I mean, because most of the time, this movie is has such a great atmosphere, and it has such a nice creepy feel, and I never feel it's an hour and 37 minutes long, and yet I never feel as if it could be shorter. Anytime I've ever tried to watch the shorter American version, I always feel like it's moving too damn fast. I don't have the time to kind of let the creepiness and the story kind of wash over me, because I feel like, wow, I'm already here. Why are we already here? Why are we already doing this? So I love the feel of the movie, and I love the way it's set up, and it's a horror movie. You don't need the best acting in the world, and at times you don't have the best acting in the world, and you don't need fully rounded characters. But I will say this, one other thing, and I had to start thinking about this a few years ago, was this came out in 71, which means it was probably in production either earlier that year or in 1970, right?
Right.
1968 is when Night of the Living Dead came out.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you'd have to admit that Tombs of the Blind Dead wouldn't exist if Night of the Living Dead hadn't been made, right?
Agreed.
Now, this is a completely different take. This is an original take on that whole idea. Oh, so yeah, this very is much very so. Much different from Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
But the influence is there, right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Then I start thinking about the compare and contrast. It's like, wow, well, wait a minute. He establishes an entire backstory. He's essentially taken what is a post-apocalyptic story from Romero and gone haunted house on us. In other words, it's just in one location. It's rooted in one spot.
Right.
And he's given it, he's given you exactly why. And unlike in Night of the Living Dead, where you never learn how the hell this all came about, he's given you this whole backstory, this whole thing about the Knights Templar and worshiping Satan and the adopting of all these old rituals and devil worship and using, you know, Egyptian symbolism to try to gain eternal life for themselves and all this kind of stuff. So in a way, Osorio's idea is to just kind of almost give you way too much information about all this stuff. Yeah. Essentially just like he's piling on more and more detail to make it more interesting. And to be honest, he does make it more interesting.
Well, I mean, they're certainly more interesting than your average, you know, typical zombie, you know, it's interesting that they kill. Their method of killing primarily is by biting, and something that I had...
I love the sword.
But I had totally forgotten the whole thing. It was nice that it had been so long since I first seen it, because I had totally forgotten the fact that it kind of retain the zombie thing about the fact that if they bite, that their corpses that they kill come back to life themselves, or animated again themselves. I don't know if that happens in any of the other Blind Dead films or not, because it's been so long since I've seen them. I don't know if that's a continual thread or if it's only explored in this film.
I do think... Wow, man, you just caught me out, because, like I said, it's been a while since I've rewatched the second and fourth ones.
Right.
I'm going to have to go back. I don't think that crops up again.
That was a one-time thing, but...
But let's start, while we start talking about the good things about the film, not just the good things, but the things that I think are really stand out about it, the amazing resurrection scene of Virginia in the morgue is wonderful.
It is.
If you want to see the difference between a crappy director and a good director, watch that sequence. And not just because you've got the crazy morgue attendant. Watch his choice of shots to build suspense in that sequence. There's an overhead shot. There are shots where a hand or a foot enters the frame from above or from the side. There are shots where he's got a character foregrounded, the crazy morgue attendant.
Right.
And you can see in the distance behind him something creeping toward him.
Yeah.
He varies his shots. He really does a fantastic job of knowing what shots he would need and then how to cut them together to really build suspense and to really ratchet things up. It's really nice.
It is.
Plus, the whole resurrected Virginia thing leads to one of the standout sequences in the entire film, which is the stalking of Beth's assistant in the mannequin factory, which is just amazing.
Yeah.
Not just the stalking aspect of it, which is all amazingly creepy and very well done, but he's able to almost overindulge in the use of lighting with the neon lights, the red and the blues and the greens. And,
And I want to bring that up because I mean, I love that sequence too, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to think about this, but I had never noticed it before. Again, it being so many years since I've seen this film, but When we first see the mannequin factory, you know, and Beth is working there, and Roger comes to visit her there, and Beth's assistant goes to answer the door, and she goes, she's walking through those mannequins, and there's that red light flashing, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, this has to be a nod to Mario Bava. It's got to be. It cannot not be a... But then, when the guy comes in, he actually calls attention to it. He says, where's that light come from? And she says, well, they just put a neon sign up here. And he says, boy, that must be annoying. And then I'm sitting there thinking, is this a little bit of a jab at Bava? You know, is it a little bit of a poke at Bava, you know? But I just think it's great that they actually
Because they're actually giving a reason for the light. Whereas Bava's always like,
no, I'm just putting a light here because it looks great. Because
it looks great,
and they're just saying, I just think it's great. So I was thinking like, wow, I wonder if it was a little bit of a twist, a little bit of a jab there, you know?
I never thought about that before, but you could be right. It could be a little bit of a it's like, I want to use this technique as well because it's fantastic, but I'm going to give a reason, and I'm going to point out that I'm giving a reason, and you never do, so
it's great. I mean, I'm sorry, I mean, because, I mean, you can't go wrong with mannequins. I mean, they're just always effective, they're always creepy, and they sure are, and they're always, I mean, it's a great scene where, you know, she's walking, where she's being stalked by Virginia, and she's just walking down this long row of mannequins, and your eyes constantly knows Virginia's got to be there among the mannequins, but where, you know, it's just
well, I know, and anybody who's ever seen, of course, by the way, the movie that we're talking is Blood and Black Lace,
right.
Which some people would have to would call the first giallo, and I don't know, maybe it is. There's always that debate back and forth about whether it's the first giallo or not, but I kind of think it probably is. There are more than a few sequences in Blood and Black Lace where this mannequin scene really looks like really looks like they're paying homage or ripping off as you say, probably very consciously going, by the way, I'm gonna use this idea too. But it's just a great scene.
And
I even think they handle the flame problem.
It's kind of one of those things where you can tell what they're doing, but it doesn't look bad. It's still
It's an old school special effect,
but it looks better than it usually does when they're trying to do that.
And it definitely didn't make me think toy boat in a wash tub.
The little flame with a little poof of little wisp of smoke as it sinks beneath the waves. It's going to
Oh God, it still makes me chuckle. Man, Elena is hating us right now. I want you to know that.
I know we're treading on sacred ground here, aren't we?
It's true.
Well, I want to just because you mentioned again a minute ago that you know the performances are
they're variable.
But I want to give two props to two standout performances to me just for kind of for different reasons. First one is Maria Elena Arpon, I guess, that played Virginia, or as she's listed here, Helen Harp. I mean,
she used the stage name Helen Harp a good bit in her career.
And we got called out for the fact that, you know, or we got called back a while back that when we were doing Hunchback in the Morgue and she was playing Ilsa, that we didn't also mention at that point. But I just want to point out, in Hunchback in the Morgue, we saw her, A, on her deathbed, B, in a wheelchair, C, as a corpse. Now here, we see her, A, jump off a moving train, B, jump onto a horse, and see jump off a horse, and at least in two of those scenes, I don't think that's a stunt person.
No, I wanted to point that out. That girl is really doing her. That.
And now, I don't care how slow a train is moving, jumping off a moving train onto gravel cannot be very much fun, and she
how
does
they,
it.
How do you convince an actor? No, just go ahead. Even though the train was, and let's be honest, that's one of the faults of the film, is that when she jumps off the train is moving at about 5 miles
exactly,
an hour.
Exactly,
they're not selling that very effectively. So.
But it's still, I mean, jumping off a moving car train at any speed, you run a big risk. You bring a big risk of hurting yourself, and she jumps onto a horse and off a horse.
I'm more impressed by the fall off of the horse
What's
more impressive is that the fall off of the horse as the knights pull her off the horse is in slow motion, and you can really see that's her.
And she I got to give her credit for that, or give the director credit for talking her into it. You know,
well, let's also give the director credit for having the first time we see her be in a bikini.
Yay! Woo!
Yeah. Always a good thing.
Yeah, I prefer her that way than a blackened corpse, as in the Hunchback of the Morgue.
Yes, exactly. The hidden, you're right, because the corpse
gets...
By
the time they get rid of her, the other performance that truly blew me out of the water, just because of what else I've seen her in, not necessarily... I mean, she's good in this, she plays the part fine, but Maria Silva, as I guess her character's name may even be Maria, but basically as Pedro's woman in this, it's... Okay, because I knew the name. I was like, okay, well, I know we've seen her in some movie before. We're going to see her eventually in Curse of the Devil when she was in Dr. Orloff. But what really truly blew me away is that she plays Abigail in, was it Abigail or maybe I'm thinking of it? But anyway, she's in Vengeance of the Mummy. She's basically Jack Taylor's, I guess, wife or companion.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, man, contrast those two performances, okay? Because in Vengeance of the Mummy, she's obviously a beautiful woman, but she's almost kind of overshadowed because you've got Hugo Lanay and the incredible actress playing,
playing the Egyptian woman.
And they get to wear their very skimpy Egyptian outfits, whereas pretty much Maria Silva's in Victorian mode the whole time. Good performance,
completely covered
good performance.
Up,
but here she's even though she's an adventurer kind of in that film, and she's very adventurous, but she's still pretty much a proper Victorian woman. Contrast that with this lusty, kind of almost like pirate woman that she's playing. I mean, she's just
very very straightforward sexually and very.
I realized that's who it was, I was thinking, okay, that's versatility there. That's she pushing.
And you're right. She is quite good, even though the character she's playing is pretty one note. I mean, honestly that leads into one of the charges that's leveled against this film, quite honestly.
Right,
which is
we might
that,
have to get into, definitely going to have to talk about this. You can't really dance around it for so long. Eventually, to talk about...
Eventually, you have to talk about the fact that it's very easy to see this as a misogynistic film.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it's impossible to not see it as a misogynistic
film. It's got some things that are pretty hard to defend in there. You know, they're pretty,
up until the end of the movie, every victim has been a woman.
Yeah.
Now, when you finally get down to it, of course, the guys start getting it pretty bad too.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, right. You get your head lopped off, and okay, you're a victim too. All right, I got you. But we have in this film, this is first of all a film that at least left the lesbian implications in, right?
The Spanish version again, the American version.
Oh, it does trim that out. That's true.
Cut that out. Yeah.
So what we have is. A film that presents, a nasty rape scene, a nasty, unnecessary, one would almost say mean-spirited rape scene, especially when you consider that the rape comes, the rape is committed after the guy who commits it learns that the woman that he rapes is probably still kind of essentially a virgin because she prefers women. It seems so mean-spirited and out of place and nasty. We already know the guy's a smuggler and a criminal.
Yeah.
And this just pushes the guy into complete scumbag territory. Mm. And the thing is, I don't think that they want us to be rooting for the blind dead to kill these people. This is not that kind of film.
It didn't seem like it, no. I didn't feel,
But we definitely do have this one character, at least, that does this reprehensible thing.
I know.
And granted, he's the first one in the group to get killed in pretty grisly fashion, but it is an unnecessary scene. I can understand all the objections to it.
Yeah.
It adds absolutely nothing to the movie.
No, and also, we also got to realize that, it would be years and years before you would start to see homosexual characters who didn't have to be punished in some way still in films.
Yeah.
You know, it was still going on. It would go on for years more. I mean, this was definitely here in the 70s. You hadn't been able to have openly homosexual characters very, very long in films anyway, but generally this time, if you had them, if they weren't just like totally comical stereotypes, they were in some way or another going to pay for, you know, be punished in some way for who they were, for being homosexuals in some
way.
Well,
that's way. True.
And, you know,
one of the strange things, actually,
in horror movies and outside of horror movies.
I told you just the other night I rewatched Bird with Crystal Plumage, and
yeah.
I don't know if you remember this or not, but there is an overly effeminate, obviously gay character in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Who isn't really played for laughs. I mean, he's kind of amusing in the way he speaks. He doesn't have a lisp or anything like that, but he's very obvious the character's gay. But it was pointed out to me that Argento actually had gay characters in a couple of his early films, and at no point was Argento appearing to make any kind of value judgment about these people. They were just
well, everybody
there
died
for,
in his films.
Well, no, I mean this
but
character,
mean, but they were there.
It was just there as color.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
as in,
right.
Oh, well, he's just, you know, he's an interesting character, and the fact that he's gay is the element that adds to his character. Mm. You know, being kind of interesting as this kind of side character who's in a couple scenes. Mm. But you're right. In general, it was a long time before, especially in serious films, quote unquote serious films, as in, you know, mysteries or films that are not meant to be comedies at all.
Right.
Yeah, the homosexuality of any type generally was punished one way or the other, and was always there was always a way found to look down upon it. So.
And you know, a few episodes back, I had mentioned the fact about how common, you know. Rape sequences, you know, appearing in films around the same time as kind of a reaction against the feminist movement, the women's lib movement. And I still think that's
an interesting theory.
Well,
and I do see where you're coming from.
I think it's
from,
a combination. It was a combination of that. It was also a combination of just sheer pure exploitation. The whole freedom given to, it's the whole reason why Paul Naschy's films, you know, why there's, you know,
why there's nudity.
Well, I was going to say in every excuse in the world to whip somebody, you know, it's like because. I mean, whippings were just basically, you know, people whip each other in these films.
Well,
and
wait a minute, we get a whipping and torture scene in this too.
Well, of course, yeah, right. When we get
when
the backstory on
the
checklist,
scene, yeah,
and so all that stuff. A lot of that was just pure, just people, you know, suddenly like the freedom that you know, we can put this on film, and not only are there actual places where it will be screened, but people will come see it for the shock value. So, you know, part of the preponderance of sexual outrage and sexual violence, let's
call it sexual violence,
came out of that. But let's talk, you know, we've seen many rape scenes so far as we've been doing Naschy Cast, because there's quite a few of them in Paul Naschy's films, but they're not really, they're always attempted rapes, and usually, 90% of the time, they're used as a means of introducing Paul Naschy's character as a good character, because he's always coming to the rescue.
Yeah, yeah,
it's a way true. Of he, and obviously Paul Naschy himself, obviously this, he saw that act, you know, as an offensive act, or saw it as and so he would use it to show his characters as being noble because they would rescue, you know,
they would rescue the person that's being persecuted.
So far, the only actual, if my memory is correct, so far the only actual rape that we've seen is when Hunchback of the Morgue. Not Hunchback of the Morgue, I'm sorry. Dr. Jekyll and the Werewolf, when Mr. Hyde rapes the heroine. But there's a real power to that scene because earlier in the film, Paul Naschy, as Waldemar Daninsky, has saved her from a rape. And so it has a lot of real emotional power when later, as Mr. Hyde, he commits the act he didn't commit as Waldemar Daninsky. So it ties into the story very well.
Yeah, exactly. There's scenes mirroring each other in the story that show you the change in the character.
Suddenly, but here in Tombs of the Blind Dead is something altogether different that's hard to, despite the, you know... Like
There is no justification
right.
for it.
We talked about at least, you know, certainly the film, the scene is shot to be very harsh. It's not shot to be titillating, you know, that we can tell and all. I mean, it's like...
No, the scene is not titillating at all. As a matter of fact, it's kind of hard to watch.
And we also talked about how, you know, that also he does an interesting thing story-wise because he keeps cutting back and forth between what's happening in... with the rape scene and then also the other characters, you know, because there's kind of the parallels between their characters and what's going on between them, you know, are interesting things. But no matter how you wrap it up, I mean, this definitely seems a case of a little too much of that whole idea of, you know, is like, well, it's just, you know, she's lesbian because she just hasn't had a real man, you know, let's go ahead and put it out there.
Yeah.
That's kind of behind a little bit too much of that. And so it's one of the things in the film that, you know, you kind of could have done without. But certainly it's one that, as you see, we had to talk about it. Everybody will always have to talk about that.
Oh, definitely.
When they talk about this film. It's
well, and it's so easy to see this as a misogynistic film. Mm. Not just because of that, but because of the very obvious attitude toward homosexuality that is evidenced in the movie, not just in that scene, but in the scene earlier, the flashback scene earlier, when we learned that that Virginia and Beth had a lesbian encounter when they were in school.
Mm-hmm.
That scene is filmed in such a silly way with this gauzy filter over, yeah. Gauzy filter over the lens, and with them acting really silly.
It's almost like they're playing house or something. Yeah, so it gives that idea about not really seriously lesbian characters. Like, it's like, this is just women playing house when men aren't around, or that kind of thing.
Yeah. But what's funny though, is it always reminds me of the old joke that's told repeatedly about how, in British upper crust society, like, All wealthy boys go off to school and they have a homosexual encounter or two, but they grow out of that. Yeah. It's just part of the growing. It's growing pains. It's just one of the things that you do.
Yeah.
And I always thought about how weird that was. That there were that apparently that's really what.
Yeah,
a lot of people think is just boys. Well, they have that thing and then you become a man. Really? Really? Okay. Well, I mean. I, if you want to, I guess. All right. The fact that it was kind of seen as awful, of course. And, of course it is.
All right.
Well, I'm having trouble picturing Winston Churchill having a homosexual encounter in his school days, but I'm guessing I'm supposed to. I don't know.
Professor Cantal?
Professor?
Yes? What do you want? The library is already closed. Didn't you know that? People are always late. That's the trouble with the world.
Excuse us, Professor. There's been a murder, a friend of ours.
Then what do you want of me? You should go to the police.
You're an authority on the Middle Ages, Professor. I'd like to know about the Templars and their ritual secrets.
You say the Templars?
Our friend was murdered at Berzano.
Huh? At Berzano? That's where the Templars' cemetery is. This is magnificent.
He's mad.
Can you tell us about it, then?
Yes, I can. Here it is. In the 12th century, the Templars fought in the Crusades. They brought back great treasures from the East with them. Oh, yes, and they also came back worshipping black magic. The Templars took over by force, and their blood rituals sacrificed every virgin girl in the village. They continued to ravage the countryside until the King of Spain conquered them and brought them to trial. They were hung and left for all to witness that witchcraft was forbidden. The crows ate the eyes out of the cadavers.
But can that be true?
Absolutely. The archives here date back 1,000 years.
What are you trying to say? Are you suggesting that some new sect is practicing the old rituals?
No, I wouldn't say that.
What then?
They're the old Templars that have come back to life.
What kind of nonsense is that?
Nonsense? Are you sure? Has science answered all the unknown questions of the world? The Templars from the East brought many secrets, and among them, they solved death and its mystery.
But that's impossible.
And now they've returned again from their tombs. They're the blind dead. But that will be no handicap, as they still can hear their victims and will continue with terror and murder.
Without wanting to be very spoilerish, as a matter of fact, not wanting to spoil the film for somebody who's never seen it at all, I would like to touch on the ending, which I think is absolutely astonishing. I love the ending because... Without ruining the film, let's just say it has a less than happy ending.
And, this is the early 70s, as we all know. Again, it's like, you realize you watch more and more of these, and you realize just how utterly, the most shocking ending of all is, if it was a very un-70s ending, let's just say, because you almost never, the more you watch the films, you just begin to realize more and more, boy, the 70s films just really had a certain way of ending films.
And it's a way that I tend to prefer, I have to admit. I mean, right now there's a raging debate about the ending of Source Code, which, after when I saw the film, it didn't even occur to me that ending might be compromised. But now there's a lot of people who are really angry because they feel that the last 5 minutes of the film kind of undermines it in a way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But to talk about Tombs of the Blind Dead, that ending, remember, I didn't see the American version, the cut down shorter version, until after I'd seen the Spanish version. My first exposure to it was the full cut. When you go to that freeze frame, and you have those screams over it, of that freeze frame there at the end.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, wow, that's amazing. What an amazing ending. Because essentially the idea is that we have now accidentally almost transported the evil from essentially the haunted place, the haunted house.
Yeah.
out into the regular world, out into that world of train stations and swimming pools and mm-hmm. modern life,
mm-hmm.
and they're just going to keep going. Mm-hmm. And that's where the film ends. I love that idea.
Well, and I just want to say right here, too, that I'm glad you said brought this up earlier about the influence of Night of the Living Dead, because that also stylistically really made me think of the ending of Night of the Living Dead. I thought that it was very much influenced by that whole the freeze frame, the use of sound. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that was very much like Night of the Living Dead's ending there.
Well, plus, the uncut version of that whole end sequence on the train, there's some harsh stuff in
yes,
there.
Yes, there
that,
are. Yes,
that
there are.
The child being splattered by the blood as her parent is killed and things of that nature. There are a lot of amazing things in this. One almost wonders, we talk about the fact that the film comes off as very misogynistic and the unnecessary rape scene, but one wonders if you almost have to be the kind of filmmaker who would include that kind of stuff
that
we kind of look askance at to be the kind of filmmaker who would include the things that you just are stunned by and think you can't imagine the film without, like having the blood splatter on the child and then having the child killed, which is just one of those incredibly shocking moments that you really only can get in these types of horror movies. Because generally, filmmakers back away from that.
Especially once again here in America, you know, especially now in America. I mean, it's like, boy, it's you know, you get in a lot of trouble. You know, it's kind of coming out of it a little bit. We're seeing more examples, but there was definitely a stretch of films or stretch during American films here in the last couple of decades where you pretty much, I mean, a child could not be harmed on screen in a story. I mean, they just couldn't do it. They would not do it.
Well, I remember the shock. The shock and kind of the happiness of Guillermo del Toro talking about his film Mimic, that he was allowed to kill kids in it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
Not violently,
right?
But he was able to actually kill kids in the movie and get away with it, and was really surprised that they let him do it.
Yeah.
And that was one of the first times. That was in like '95. It was one of the first times hearing him say that, thinking to myself, "Oh, wow. I guess that is kind of a prohibition, isn't it? That's something they don't want you to do."
No.
And it had not really occurred to me. You know, it's like once they get to be teenagers, then you can off them left and right. But like under the age of 12, don't touch them. But
yeah,
The parallel to Night of the Living Dead is well taken, though. The freeze frames and the continuing of the sound and the voices over those still images. Yeah, you're right. That's another thing linking it to Night of the Living Dead stylistically. So, Tombs of the Blind Dead is an iconic Spanish horror film. As a matter of fact, if you were to approach me and say, "I think the best Spanish horror film ever made is Tombs of the Blind Dead," I would argue with you, possibly, but not very hard.
Well, yeah, I think if you're going to make a list of, you know, not only in terms of favorite or best made, but just essential altogether, you know, to Spanish horror. I mean, gosh, it'd have to be in the top of the list. It'd have to be like top three, you know, I would think.
Any list of European horror films from any decade. I mean, if you were just including, you know, from now back to the 50s, just, okay, list them off and list them in the order of quality. This would be in the top 10. And in my opinion, it'd be in the top five.
Yeah. And by the way, I think the point that you might not have totally made the point you were going to make if you were planning to make it, that we will say that basically the English version screws up the ending too.
The English language version does screw up the ending because it takes out the freeze frame.
I know it takes. It makes that. Well, it, yeah, it does. I mean, story still essentially ends the same, but nowhere near as stylistically effective. You know,
it ends on the scream.
Yeah.
Which they even managed to screw up, because think if they had started the film, instead of taking that flashback showing you the Templar Knights out and shoving it at the beginning, if they had started the movie the way the movie starts in the Spanish version with that scream, because when you get to the end, you have that scream and you realize who you're looking at.
Exactly, yeah.
And what happened, you realize it all right then, all in one big shot. You're like, oh my God, that was the thing from the beginning of the film. Because by then, it's an hour and a half ago, you've forgotten about that. And then it happens again, and you go to that freeze frame, and it's just, oh, wow. Which is one of those great moments in horror cinema, I think, because you automatically get that sense of just overwhelming dread and realize, wow, this is where the film ends.
Yeah.
This is impressive. You know, whoa, they really took it, didn't they? They really did this.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. The American version, the English language version,
Totally botches it.
Totally botches it. Yeah.
But yeah, talking about these films, talking about the films being iconic, or this film in particular, but it's the nice thing about the whole Blind Dead, as far as the quartet of films, is, you know, you're definitely lucky in that respect. Anybody who wants to delve into them, is all four of them came out, you know, right at the same time in great quality
on DVD,
DVDs,
yeah.
You know, and they're just right out there, right to see.
I highly recommend the Blue Underground Coffin Box set, because it's got all four films, both versions of Tombs, and there are a couple extras on each disc. Nothing too major, but there's an entire fifth disc that includes a documentary just on Osorio. And I have to admit, even all these years later, I've owned this thing for, what, 5 or 6 years now. I still haven't watched the stupid documentary about Osorio, which of course paints me as a horrible, horrible Spanish horror film fan, I know, but I still haven't watched it because I keep forgetting it's there. Every time I pop that box open, I'm going to pull one of the films out, and I go, oh yeah, that's sitting there.
I've just got the films individually, so I would love to see that too. I don't have that actually.
What's horrible is the same thing like that fantastic documentary about Stanley Kubrick.
Oh yeah.
I can't remember the name of it now, but it came with the initial box set of his films that came out on DVD. Mm-hmm. And for years, I've been going, man, I can't wait to see that, and I still haven't watched it. I'm so terrible about that kind of thing. Oh man, it's just awful, awful, awful.
Yeah, because we have to buy it the day it comes out, and then we don't watch it for like years. Well, then
I wallow in the films.
Right.
And I will end up wallowing in commentary tracks and things like that. Yeah. But it's almost as if the effort it takes to put the other disc in to watch the documentary is just too freaking much.
Oh, and my favorite is what they did with the Val Lewton set. There's not one, but two documentaries, because the first time it came out had the initial documentary, then they came out with it again with the one that Martin Scorsese did, and so now there's
I ended up just taping the freaking Scorsese documentary and keeping that as a separate disc. I was like, I ain't going through that again, you bastards. But an iconic film, Tombs of the Blind Dead, is if you haven't seen it, we highly recommend it. Watch the Spanish language cut, read the subtitles, make yourself a happy person.
And now, we
do need to bring up one other thing.
Shall we talk about the most iconic version?
Oh, it's not. Don't do that to me, man. Oh, well, okay, here's the thing. Okay. Something that had been apparently a rumor that turned out to be true. One of the great joys of the Blue Underground set is that they did find an incredibly rare thing. If you'll remember when Tombs of the Blind Dead came out, 1971, the early 70s. Of course, the film played in its English language cut. It played drive-ins around
houses and drive-ins.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anytime you have a film that's going around the country like that, you're going to have distributors trying to find ways to entice people into the theater to see their film in less than honest ways. Let's just say.
Well, I mean, we started our whole Nashie Guest off with Frankenstein's Bloody Terror, a film which did not feature Frankenstein at all.
yeah, exactly. If it, I mean, it has vampires and it has a werewolf, but it certainly ain't got no Frankenstein monster.
Nope.
So, in this case, apparently there was a distributor somewhere who decided to try to take his print of Tombs of the Blind Dead and find a way to link it to the, remember, this was the early 70s.
Right.
The then huge craze of interest in Planet of the Apes and all the sequels to the original film. Ape madness ruled the United States.
Those films, for those of us, we remember, those of us who were young enough that time, that was incredible.
I was on the back end of it, but the ape thing was huge. I mean, four sequels, a TV series, a Saturday morning cartoon series,
comic book magazine,
comic books magazine, kinds. I mean, it was big, 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 big. I can remember desperately wanting the Planet of the Apes Migos action figures. Oh, I wanted those things.
I had them. I will torture you with that.
Bastard! Do you still have them?
I was gonna
call up your dad and try to.
They all probably at this point they all probably pretty much look like the apes would look if had they actually been in this next film we're going to talk about.
Well, good point. This distributor decided to try to link his copy of Tombs of the Blind Dead to the Planet of the Apes franchise to get more bums in seats, and created a prologue and retitled the movie Revenge of Planet Ape. If you think we're joking, we're not, because the proof is on the Blue Underground DVD. You can see the silly, silly prologue that this person put together. And as a matter of fact, for your listening joy, you don't even have to go to that route. Mm. We'll let you hear right now the prologue to this particular ridiculous version of Tombs of the Blind Dead.
Legend has it, almost 3,000 years ago, a simian civilization of super intelligent apes struggled with man to gain control of this planet. In the end, man conquered ape after a brutal battle, which saw him destroy the ape, his culture, and society. After this battle, man tortured and killed all the ape prisoners by piercing their eyes with a red-hot poker. One of the prisoners, who was also the leader of the apes, vowed they would return from the dead to avenge man's brutality at a point in time before man destroyed Earth himself. That time is now.
Now, I don't know how much I would have paid back in the day, back in the day for a combination. I don't know what I'd pay right now for a combination of Planet of the Apes and Tombs of the Blind Dead.
That's why I was going to ask you that question because I happen to know what a fanatic you are about the whole Planet of the Apes series. So I was wondering if the wheels were actually spinning in your mind and you were thinking this would have been a great idea. But I also too,
I do think it's a great idea. Yes,
well, you know, we talk about how much we love, you know, to us, it was like, this truly does sum up, if you wanted to just sum up the whole exploitation era, drive-in distribution era, you know, that would do it. And of course, to us, in retrospect, you know, we laugh about it, and it is definitely very charming. I have to say, I don't know how charmed I would be had I been one of the people who actually plunked down, put my bum in a seat, expecting to see a Planet of the Apes film.
Well, no, I'm just picturing some poor sucker in 1973 going to a drive-in, and one of the films playing is Revenge of the of Planet Ape, and I'm thinking, yeah, man, more ape ass kicking. Yeah. And you get in there and you're like, what?
Well, and along that same lines, then I picture what really cracks me up is to think of this person for years ranting about this sixth ape film that people insist, what? You're insane. No, I swear, there's a sixth ape.
Somehow they survived and they came through. What in the future? No, no. What in the future?
Like, they're all these skeleton apes, and they're rising from the
dead, and they're coming and killing. They have swords.
Like, dude, you did get the bad acid, didn't you?
When
you
saw yeah, really. Something was very, very wrong with you. Something was not good that day. Oh, Lord. Well, all right, people. All right.
Tombs of Blind Dead, a classic. If you are the rare listener that's listening to this cast and have not seen it, see it.
Yeah, go see it immediately. All right, we're going to quickly get to a few pieces of email, and then we'll let you in on what the next Nashy Cast is going to be about. Well, actually, I guess some of them you probably should
know.
We told them
last episode.
Our next regular Nashy episode is going to be Human Beasts. We'll get to more announcements after that. But right now, let's jump into the mailbag here. This is from Thomas. Who we've read, I think we've read emails from him before. Yeah, we have. Says, greetings. I hope this email finds you both well. As to whom is Dr. Jekyll and to whom is the Wolfman, maybe we should do a listener's poll.
No, that's right. He was the one who first addressed us as Dr. Jekyll and the Wolfman, and we've worn those badges proudly there.
Yeah. I guess it's really, that should probably be up to the people who are closer to us in life, which is which.
Yeah.
Okay. He says, Thomas says, what can I say about The Hunchback of the Morgue? I really, 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 really liked it. Really. It definitely is one of Nashy's best. Although having once owned a pet rat, I could have done without the burning rats alive scene. But those were different times. Like Sam Peckinpah's opening of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, where they make live chickens' heads explode.
Well, and I also want to say that I want to interject here that I just saw at the local theater here, again, raving about our wonderful Belcourt Theater, is that, speaking of classic 70s films, they just showed Cockfighter with Warren Oates.
The Monty Hellman film.
At the end of that, me and the buddies I was seeing it with, we were kind of joking about, gee, where's the usual disclaimer about no animals were harmed in the making of... It's like, you mean there was no monitor from the Humane Society on this film? Yeah, that's if you happen to just love them cute little chickens, don't go see that one.
Yeah, Cockfighter is a hell of a film.
Oh, it is. That's true.
Masterful performance from Warren Oates.
Oh, he's amazing.
It's just amazing, that film. But yeah, they definitely did not used to have the prohibitions against killing animals that they do now.
No.
I love Pat Garrett and Billy Kidd, too. So.
Yeah, that's a great film.
He says, I chuckled at Nashy waving his fist at the young kids and half expected him to break out into a Walter Brennan impression. Dagnabbit, kids!
Dagnabbit!
I can see it is a very powerful film, and I can see why he was so proud of it. Seeing this film made me realize how happy I am that I found your podcast. I might never have seen this or many of the other great Nashy films without you guys pointing me in the right direction. So thanks for being my gateway to the Nashyverse. Now, I have to say, I'm kind of surprised by that. We've stated before that the reason we started in this podcast, besides the fact that I kind of wished that there was something like this around so that I could listen to it, is that we kind of thought that what we would be doing, seriously, is merely just preaching to the choir.
Yeah, yeah.
At most, we thought that we would occasionally talk about a film that maybe a Nashy fan hadn't been able to get his hands on.
Right, right.
But in general, we really kind of thought, we didn't see this as a proselytizing thing. We weren't going out into the masses to convert anybody to our particular religion.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess maybe we might be.
Maybe the revival has begun. The groundswell is,
I guess so. I guess so. It's just not what we expected.
But no, you're welcome, Thomas. Like I said, I don't know whether to be proud or feel proud or guilty, but we will take responsibility for ushering you into.
Anytime I feel pride, it is followed immediately by guilt. It's all covered. It's good. Back to his email. I'm disappointed that Strange Loves of the Vampire is insanely hard to find. It sounds like such an interesting movie, and I'll watch anything with Emma Cohen.
Oh, yeah.
No kidding. Maybe some company like Blue Underground needs to do a Leon Klimovsky box set, and we'll have great editions of I Hate My Body, Vampire's Night Orgy, and Strange Loves of the Vampires. That will always be the dream.
I'll just say right here, as I've said before, as long as there is a Coffin Joe box set in the world, which there is, anything is possible.
I agree. Thomas says, I was recently re-listening to your Count Dracula's Great Love podcast. I like that movie, but it is such a mess story-wise. But I found something interesting this time around. In that movie, it's said Dracula would always be there whenever man was evil and spilled another man's blood. Does this make Nashy's Dracula a kind of vampiric Tom Joad from The Grapes of Wrath? Wherever there is a badly delivered cat scare, I'll be there. That is probably my favorite cat scare moment from any movie, and I'm surprised she wasn't decapitated by the flying feline. Thomas, you are so right.
No, I always just picture wonder if they actually swung the cat by the tail around a few times before letting it fly.
No, what I picture is an intricate cat gun constructed with rubber bands, like some damn Far Side.
Yeah, really, yeah.
Far like Side cartoon. Shoot the cat across the room.
They loaned it out probably to various films, for it was on loan from the studio. But yeah, the whole Dracula, the whole never being able to lock down exactly what Dracula was, it's like, Dracula is this romantic guy that frees little rabbits from traps, but he also demands the suffering of an innocent. I remember that part there. I'm going to whip this girl for an hour.
It's one of the many problems with the movie is that it never seemed to know just what in the hell it was doing with most any of its characters, most especially Dracula.
Yeah.
Okay, back to Tom's email. Cannot wait to hear you guys tackle Tombs of the Blind Dead and El Caminante. Well, we've done that now, so there you go.
Mm-hmm.
I really wish some company would release the Nashy films that do have a good DVD release overseas here in the States. I'm in the process of tracking down a multi-region DVD player, so hopefully I can get a few more titles added to my growing list of my growing Nashy collection. Pardon me. On a non-Nashy but still Euro-Hara note, I did manage to track down the Dark Sky Films DVD of Mario Bava's Kill Baby Kill. I guess they lost the rights to it or something, because man, is it hard copy to find. Well, no, let me explain to you what happened. When Dark Sky was producing their Kill Baby Kill DVD, Anchor Bay was producing one as well, and they had supposedly worked out some kind of deal where both of them were going to put the film out at the same time. This has happened a few times before, where Blue Underground and Shriek Show put out versions of Zombie at the same time, Lucio Fulci's film Zombie, and each DVD had different extras, and they agreed to it, they settled some behind the scenes stuff, and that's what happened. But unfortunately, with the Dark Sky Films DVD, it never actually came out because the other company stomped on them and kept them from doing it. The real crime there is, from what I have heard, the Dark Sky Film version may have looked a little bit better, but also, of course, it had, as Tom points out in his email, it had Tim Lucas's commentary track on the film on it, and the other disc did not have that. Why that DVD is so hard to come by is that it was never made commercially available. Wow. A few advanced copies got out there for people to review before they had to completely shut it all down and destroy the whole thing. So what you've gotten your hands on is a bootleg, I'm assuming, of one of those few copies that got out there for reviewers.
Good find, Tom.
Good find. I'd love to get my hands on that commentary. Just got obviously the commentary track is the real loss from that release, and I'd love to get my hands on it as well.
And you know they just had to twist Tim's arm to get him to talk about Baba.
You know, he just doesn't like to talk about Baba. He hates to talk about Baba. He just, I think really, he's probably really sick of people even bringing him up.
I mean.
Okay. That will wrap it up for now. Until next time, guys, may flying cats, human zebras, and truck drivers named Pierre stay clear of your path. Best wishes, Tom.
And to that I'll add, and may nothing Manosian enter your life.
Manosian. Oh, that's, yes, that's very true. Okay, next email from Michael, or from Mike. I guess he goes by Mike, appears.
Yes, Michael says, "Hi guys, I composed this email last week but never sent it. Fantastic job as always. Many of us have been anticipating this episode for some time and I think it's one of your best." Believe you, he's talking about the Hunchback.
He's talking about the Hunchback, yeah.
Yeah, I think that has been one of our most popular. I think the Hunchback and the Werewolf Shadow shows we did seem to have really gotten the biggest responses. But, you know, let's face it, we've knocked it out of the park every time because that's just
how awesome we are.
I know. So why are we even discussing it?
Now the guilt's descending on me.
I should have said that. Yeah, the guilt's descending on me. Dracula demands the suffering of, demands the self-flagellating of the Nashy casters. Rod, I share your disappointment in Maya's half-assed job on their Hunchback DVD. While it's great to have the film available, they could have done so much better. The English subtitles in particular are some of the worst I've ever seen, and the picture is nothing to write home about either. Someday I'd like to take a crack at redoing the subtitles.
Dude, if you think the subtitles on the Hunchback disc are bad, trust me, you've not seen some of their other DVDs where the subtitles are so freaking bad, they make my eyes bleed and make me want to kill whoever thought this was a good idea. Oh, man. I actually don't think the subtitles on Hunchback are too bad. There are a few screw-ups here and there, but I don't think they're that bad.
I'm glad we've got these people out there in the world that are heroically redoing some of these subtitles that are out there and all, doing the jobs that should be done on them. All right, Troy, I was pleased to hear that H.P. Lovecraft is your favorite author. He's been my favorite for most of my life, too, and we discovered him the same way, via the ads in the back of Famous Monsters. I must have been about 11 or 12 when I stumbled upon one of those Ballantine paperbacks at the library. Having recognized it from the ad, I checked it out, and when I read the part in The Lurking Fear about the guy's face having been chewed off, it sent a palpable shock through me like I had never experienced with a book before. I was hooked. I've been a Lovecraft geek ever since. I love him too, and I think, I was thinking about this the other day, that I think where the Lovecraft kind of real attention started to be paid to his work really kind of began, as it did with a lot of things. I mean, Stephen King's Dance Macabre, That was such a wonderful, if no one's ever read that, it's such a wonderful history. It's more of a personal history of horror. Yeah. It's not really like a scholarly, it's more like Stephen King's own personal history of horror. But that pointed so many people in the direction of so many cool things, and one of them was Lovecraft. I think that was one of the first probably people who wrote about, I think King was one of the first people that really kind of wrote about Lovecraft and called modern readers to his, to attention to his work.
I think you're right. I remember reading that book as well at the time because, of course, at the time I was reading everything Stephen King wrote.
Yeah.
And
there was a time when that was nice to do,
The thing is, I will say, because we've talked about this before, I came to Lovecraft in a different way. I came to Lovecraft, I'm pretty sure, if memory serves me, I came to him through reading Robert E. Howard stories.
Yeah, right.
Because I had read the Conan stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And had picked up some Solomon Kane stuff and a few other things, and then picked up a collection of his horror short stories called Pigeons from Hell.
Mm-hmm.
And Pigeons from Hell is still one of the few things I've ever read in my life that sent a real shiver down my spine as I was reading it. It just scared the living hell out of me. And it was through reading Robert E. Howard that led me to Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And I, of course, love him to death as well. But.
Yeah. And Mike's right. I mean, it's just looking at them when we used to read those famous monsters. Yeah, I would always just stare at those Ballantine paperback covers for hours and like just think, like, I've got to read this Lovecraft guy.
Yeah.
He says, can you continue? Michael says, I'm slightly bummed that there are a finite amount of Nashi films left for you guys to dissect. But as you're already branching out into other areas, it seems we won't be getting rid of you that easily. Nope. We are the scary, over-friendly guests that will never
leave. We did a quick count a couple of weeks ago, and in all honesty, we're good for a good long while. Yeah, we've got a number of films to touch on, and man, I don't think we're gonna be running out of subject matter for this podcast for some time to come. So
yeah, I mean, but I think we're gonna keep going until our NashiCast inbox just gets down to those Tool, nothing but the Tool tribute band that we keep getting spams from.
and the penis enlargement.
Exactly. We may be desperate enough to read those out loud. I don't know, but as long as we get emails from the rest of you, we won't have to stick that.
I would read those out loud, but there's no punctuation in any of them. It's like it was written by somebody on speed.
Somebody just so amazed by the size of their penis that they just they can't.
Look at what has happened to
them. Maybe they're typing with their penis. Maybe they're actually, you know.
Now that I would be impressed by.
Yeah.
If they have a video of that. You need to post that. You post that on the internet. I'm willing to surf the inner tubes and check that out. All right, next email is another one from your brother. Your brother is just batting down the hatches here.
My brother has found it. He has no life now that he's in, now that he's got NashiCast to listen to.
He says, "Hey guys, listened to NashiCast number 13 last Sunday night and enjoyed the heck out of it as always. You guys deserve the Distinguished Service Cross for taking on this monumental challenge." He's of course talking about Fury of the Wolfman.
Yes.
I watched it a couple of weeks ago, and afterwards I sat there saying, "What the hell just happened?" So then I watched it a second time the following weekend, and I was determined to not let it lose me this time. And sure enough, it made much more sense on the second viewing. Maybe that is the beauty of a film like this. When you finally kind of figure out what is happening, your feeling of accomplishment kind of endears it to you. Anyway, the culmination of this process was a week after my second viewing when I listened to your expert breakdown and analysis. Thank you.
The film will give you a breakdown, that's for sure.
back to Pac's email. Looking back now, I feel that Fury of the Wolfman is very much essential Nashi viewing and really not all that bad at all. I'm sure you guys share my sentiment that even the lower tiered offerings from Nashi are great fun regardless. Thanks for letting me share in your thoughts and observations in NashiCast 13. There is nothing else in the entertainment world that can hold my full and undivided attention like the NashiCast does. Moving forward, I'm planning on rewatching Hunchback of the Morgue this weekend to prepare for listening to NashiCast 14. I remember loving it when I watched it for the first time about a year ago, and can't wait to hear your guys' takes on it. Keep up the great work, and long live the NashiCast.
Well, as I've said before, if it wasn't for my older brother, I wouldn't even be sitting here doing NashiCast. I'd probably be a much more responsible adult, and who would want that?
who would want that? That would be, that'd be depressing, really.
It would.
About it that way. Okay, another email. We got another one from Mark here. He says, "Hey guys, congratulations on your latest discovery. Who thought there'd be a Klimovsky vampire film that nobody'd ever heard of? Sounds like an interesting one as well. Shame the quality is so lacking." That would, of course, be Strangelove the Vampire.
Mm-hmm.
"In the past, I've sat through some terrible quality bootlegs. I once had a copy of Tortured Dungeon that flickered constantly, had bits missing, and was in black and white for most of its running time. All this and direction by Andy Milligan.
Ouch.
But I still watched it a few times. Since the advent of DVD, I find I'm a little more picky regarding picture quality, but hopefully it will surface somewhere in a better quality print. Nice to hear Salem's Lot get a mention, one of my very favorite films. My cousin was on holiday in America when it first aired, and he wasn't allowed to watch it, but apparently my uncle pretty much shat his pants when he saw it, and that was recommendation enough for us. It's never had much love on DVD, and I'd really like to see a fully loaded special edition of that film one day. A Toby Hooper, David Soul commentary is something I'd pay hard cash for."
I'm not going to ask if David Soul's ever done a commentary. I figure he probably has not. But has Toby Hooper, besides Texas Chainsaw, ever done any other commentary?
You know, I don't think he has.
Or did he do one? Did he ever do one for Life Force? Or
no, he didn't do one. No. The Life Force has always been a bare bone release. He may have done one. I think he did do one for that most recent DVD release of Texas Chainsaw 2.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think he did, as a matter of fact. I can't be positive, but I think he did. I've got the disc. I'd have to look back at it. But Yeah, beyond that, I don't know.
I'd love
know
to hear him do one for Funhouse. I bet he's never done one for Funhouse.
Oh, I love Funhouse.
I'd love to hear him do one for that.
As boring as I think Eaten Alive is, Funhouse is amazing.
Funhouse is a blast. I really enjoy that movie.
Let's see. Speaking of DVD releases, I couldn't find any details of a new Vampire's Night Orgy release. Where did you hear about this? Hope the rumors are true. It's a very solid piece of Spanish horror, definitely in need of an upgrade. Now, I can't remember. I hate to tell you, Mark, I can't remember where I read that there's going to be another release, a DVD release later this year of Vampire's Night Orgy. And what I need to do is I need to do some research again and find out who's supposedly putting it out. It is supposed to be in the fall. I'm assuming that they're aiming for an October release for the obvious Halloween tie-in. But I tell you what, once I know, I will post the information on the Bloody Pit, on my blog, on the Bloody Pit of Rod, and make sure that the information is out there, because that film really does need a decent release. It's never had a DVD release over here, and it deserves one.
So we're waiting on that, just as we're waiting on this damn Horror Express DVD to finally come out and all
that. Well, that is supposedly coming out.
But they still never given any kind of date, have they?
We still don't have a date on it, but it is coming. So
those will be definitely Nashie Cast material when they're finally out.
Oh, definitely. We'll have to do Horror Express. All right, one more email.
Okay. Yeah, actually a combination of two from... we have another Spanish listener. This is Louis from Portugal has contacted us, and a new listener. He says, hello, Nashie Casters. Well, I say he's a new listener. He says here, I've been following the program since number one, so he's not a new listener. He's just now a
first-time writer.
And have to tell you, it's one of the best I've heard and the only one I look forward to. Wow.
Thank you. The balance
between background information, scenes, description, and good fun makes it an amazing companion to the already great movies. Fortunately, I have most of the films you've covered, and I've even heard some casts while watching the movie on an all-new viewing of the films. It says, even though I've been a cult horror fan for a long time, for some reason, only some years ago, I came to know Nashie's work. On a trip to Spain, I was looking for DVDs when I stumbled upon The Hunchback Digipack. I had to buy it based on the cover images alone, and that was my first Nashie experience. Wow, that was a good place to come in. And the start of an amazing ride, looking for more films from him. From then on, I researched the wonderful Mark of Nashie website, and I'm still amazed at the material I still need to get or isn't available. It says, listen to El Caminante 2 days ago, such an unknown gem. This movie really deserved to get more recognition. The one thing that I find could be bettered on that movie is the scene where Nashie's crucified in the ruins near the end. Maybe it's because I'd seen that image in a book long before I had the film and always thought it was amazing. When I finally saw it, it was merely a few seconds and static. We get some nice camera movements in the ruins in the final scene, but that one with Nashie mirroring Jesus only needed to be longer and a little more worked up and would have been an unforgettable one. I think it's an interesting point he brings up there. And I can see he's probably right. Because that's the whole concept of the scene was just an amazing culmination of the film you've seen before, but it probably actually deserved it. It probably could have been even more monumental. It probably deserved just a little more attention. Once again, it might have been reaching that point in the filming where, you know, I mean, it's possible that if that was one of the later things they filmed, time may have been running out.
Two things occur to me. One technical and one not. I think the last time I looked at that image, I think that it is a forced perspective shot. In other words, I don't think that Nashie was actually strung up directly across from that stone cross.
Interesting.
I see what you're saying. They picked their shot. I don't think they could set it up that way. Mm. And I think they framed the image so that it looks like he's directly across from it. I think it's a forced perspective shot because for some reason...
I can see what you're saying.
That's why... Because I would have preferred a nice camera move where while he's delivering his lines,
you come around
and you've started out and you're like behind him and you're seeing the stone crucifix, and then as you come around and he's delivering the line, that would have been wonderful. But I don't think that the way they for whatever reason either they didn't want to or they couldn't.
Yeah, I was about to say, I might just realized he didn't have the means to do. They may have had to just film the scene quickly and simply and get it done. Right.
I can see where he's coming from.
I do too. He says, okay, Louis continues on. He says, I almost jumped for joy when you said, Tomb of the Blind Dead, talking about that would be our next cast. He says, I've lost track of how many times I've watched it. Love it, love it. He says, something I'd like to hear on Beyond Nashie is who can kill a child. He says, don't know if there are any Nashie connections or how strict you're about it, but it would make for a perfect cast. The Hanging Woman would also be fun. It says, for Nashie movies, I'm sure you'll get to it, but really looking forward to The Beast and the Magic Sword.
We will eventually get to Beast and the Magic Sword. Have no fear. Looking forward to going back to that movie. As for, well, the Hanging Woman actually has a supporting role with Nashy.
Nashy is in it.
Mm-hmm. So it is a supporting role. So I almost would prefer to do that as a Beyond Nashy show.
Probably not one you'd want to do.
He didn't write. He didn't direct. He's just a hired actor on it, and it really is kind of a minor role in the film. But I enjoy the film. And as to the idea of covering, well, we're not real strict about, I think we started out being kind of strict about there being some Nashy connection. Yeah. But I think as we go along, these 0.5 Beyond Nashy episodes, we may get a little less strict about it because yeah. I want to cover a couple of interesting Jess Franco movies from the period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I can't, there's the occasional actor crossover between the two of them, but we're not going to be that strict, so... Doing Who Can Kill a Child, I think, is a really good idea because it's an amazing film.
I'd be happy to have an excuse to watch it because ever since I first heard about it, I've always wanted to see it. So I would,
right. You've never seen it.
Since the first time I read about it, I thought, wow, this sounds really interesting.
We actually do have a good DVD of it over here. It got released a couple of years ago. So.
Yeah, I think, because even without Nashy connections, I think that, the other idea was just in general, we start thinking, well, really, we want to look at Spanish horror of the 70s, but I'm sure there's going to be a couple we're going to look at that are probably going to predate, that era and maybe even a couple after. I don't know, we're not getting too militant about it. I think, it's not going to take much to convince us. If there's something we're wanting to see, and we'll find some excuse to be able to watch it. So, Louis then sent another, I replied to Louis and he sent another, email back. And, this is really interesting, that we're reading tonight because it ties very much into our show, because I had wondered myself how much the Blind Dead had continued to resonate in Spanish popular culture. I mean, we knew it was just the four movies, and to my knowledge, they've not popped up in any other movies or television shows, but I'd be interested in knowing also if they've been parodied or satirized in any way in Spanish popular culture on, say, TV shows or comedies or that sort of thing. But I was thinking about the whole thing about, comic books and memorabilia and that sort of thing. But what Louis sent here is really interesting. Some of this I knew about and some of it I definitely did not. But he says, about Tombs of the Blind Dead, I don't know if you're aware or interested in including this information, but there are several references to the Blind Dead in heavy metal bands that shows how it has permeated into popular culture. The British band Cathedral has three tracks about the Blind Dead, Templars Arise, Night of the Seagulls, and Ghost Ship of the Blind Dead, and a vinyl single with an image from the film on the cover. There's a Spanish band, I guess it's Machetazo, M-A-C-H-E-T-A-Z-O, did a concept album about the whole series, Sinfonias del Terror Ciego.
Damn, I need to hear that.
A Swedish band called the Coffin Shakers, which is a great title. The Coffin Shakers have a track called In the Tombs, which is included in the vinyl single Return of the Vampire. And most of the covers from a Finnish band, actually, called Hooded Menace, which itself, the title sounds like the Blind Dead, features the Blind Dead. Apparently, they're, it says they've got, it looks like three album covers. And he sends links here that have links to some of the album covers, which are terrific, some great artwork. And so that's something I was thinking of bringing up.
He's got some YouTube videos here.
Yeah, he sent a.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll post these YouTube videos up on the Bloody Pit of Rod.
Okay, cool.
And that way people can check that out too.
Yeah, maybe some of these artwork too here. Yeah, you might want to post up on there too.
I think I will. Bands.
And that's great news. And now you had told me because we were talking about this off air here, but you said that you were aware of a comic book that had been
done. At least one comic book called it started out life as a short story or a chap book called Ascension of the Blind Dead by David Z. I would pronounce David's last name, but I just know I will screw it up. But he has a number of blogs, but his main blog is called Tomb It May Concern. Which I think
I like that.
T-O-M-B.
Tomb May Concern. Nice.
And he's a writer and a blogger and just a really nice, I mean, honestly, a great guy. If I told you how many amazing things this guy has pointed me toward that I've ended up loving. I mean, the book I'm reading right now is from a men's adventure series that I only know about because David Z has pointed me toward it. Tomb It May Concern. You'll find links to his other blogs, and one of his blogs is just called is called Tales of the Blind Dead, and he had his really neat short story turned into a short comic book piece as well. by artist Billy George. And it's in color and everything. And if you go to his go to that blog, you can read the entire comic book right there. It was recently published in a collection called Zombie Terrors, which was great. Don't get me wrong, but you don't even have to buy that. Mm-hmm. You can just go straight to the web and you can read the comic book right there. And what's great is it is a new Blind Dead story, and it sets itself up to continue telling more stories, which I hope he does. And what's even better is it melds not just the Blind Dead, but we have a female werewolf. There are mentions of the Lorelei, which is a reference to another Osorio film completely. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of references to other bits of Italian and Spanish horror. It's really, really cool. It's something you really need to check out.
Cool.
Once again, go to Tomb It May Concern or Tales of the Blind Dead. Both of them are on Blogspot. And you can check this stuff out. There may be other stuff out there as well. I don't know, but I really loved it. The fact that when he brought in all the references to other Osorio films as well, because I even think there's a reference to Night of the Sorcerers.
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome. It's a blast.
And it's great that he had the female werewolf in there, because that had actually another thing that had been on my mind was that. It's a shame that we never got an El Hombre Lobo meets the Blind Dead film, and so we'll throw that out as the last really gripping intellectual question: is who would win in a fight between El Hombre Lobo and the Blind Dead? But I want to see that movie. I want to see that movie directed by Del Toro. That's my dream.
Get Guillermo del Toro to make the Blind Dead versus the werewolf.
El Hombre Lobo. That would be.
God, every geek cell in my body is vibrating with joy at the very idea. Oh, that'd be amazing.
On the Planet of the Apes.
We perverted it into a Planet of the Apes sequel. of course. All right, people. Okay.
I believe that does it. I think we're...
Yeah. Actually, I thought that at some point we would talk even more about some of Osorio's other films. But, I think we'll probably cover some more Osorio films in 0.5 episodes in the future. So, hey. One thing we'd like to point out is the next regular episode is Human Beast, and we're going to, I hope we don't piss anybody off, but we are going to take a break from the 0.5 episodes for May.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to do a 0.5 episode in May, mainly because we've got a couple of events that are coming up that are going to suck up a good bit of our time.
Yeah.
We have a convention we go to in Louisville, Kentucky in May, and we're just not going to be able to really kind of spend enough time on these as we would like.
Right.
So we're going to take May off, and then when we come back in June, we will have another 0.5 episode in June, which might not be a regular one. It might be something a little bit special. Yeah, so
cooking up some things. We'll see what transpires. May have some nice surprises coming along the way.
Yeah. Keep your fingers crossed, people. Could be interesting. But I guess that with that, we'll leave you. Put this one to bed.
Yeah. Please keep sending us letters to nashycast@gmail.com. And keep reading Rod's amazing blog, The Bloody Pit of Rod.
I don't know how amazing it is. I let it grow fallow occasionally, but okay. keep in touch. Drop us an email. Let us know what you think. And it's nashycast@gmail.com. We'll be glad to hear from you. Any ideas? Any criticisms? If you want to just heap praise on us, please feel free. All right, folks, we'll talk to you again soon. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And we will talk to you later.
The end appears upon our screen. Just hear the audience crying. Not for happy lovers, but for food that's satisfying. You bet! The cries for armor star, the prank burner, delicious. Get yours at a refreshment bar. They're juicy and nutritious. If drinks are what you want, we've got them. Hot and cold, just holler. All drinks taste good with Armor Franks. You bet your bottom dollar. Or if your taste for popcorn sets, we have it hot and waiting. For extra treat, just buy a bag. It's fun to eat when dating.
But don't forget your Armor Franks. Act on our proposition.
Come one, come all, come eat your fill. Right now it's intermission.